Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Paul Watson, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist, National Magazine Award winner, best-selling author. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Today, we're going to be talking about Afghanistan. We are abandoning Afghanistan for the same reason we invaded it, because that's what the Americans are doing. We'll take a look at the coverage. And if Justin Trudeau is Veruca Salt, does that make Aaron O'Toole Augustus Gloop? Not these days, Paul. I mean, have you seen Aaron O'Toole lately? That's a thirst trap conservative. Mercy. Glad to have you here.
Thanks very much. I despair for the future of our country, Jesse.
Well, every week we do that.
Sure.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to listeners by Brian Jackson, Sherry Little, Susan Rhodes, William Holmes, Sandra Bauer, Patrick Casey, Wendy Morohovitz, and Majd al-Shehabi.
Hi, my name is Majd al-Shehabi. I'm a technologist and urban planner based in Toronto. I support Canada Land because it provides us with a critical perspective. It also gives us an alternative business model to support for the production of news.
Desperate to flee Taliban rule, Afghans are resorting to this, grasping at U.S. military aircraft and risking their lives.
At least seven people were killed on that tarmac today. While all Canadian diplomats have now left the country, hundreds of Afghan allies who worked for Canada are still trapped there.
Fear cuts through the voice of an Afghan interpreter who we are calling Khan for his safety. Afghan interpreters were critical to Canada's military in Afghanistan. And as aids to Canadians, their need to flee has become even more desperate.
A former Canadian Army interpreter says the Afghan government is trying to calm the rising sense of panic and putting up roadblocks for those who wish to leave.
Morrow is still in contact with his interpreter in Afghanistan. It's someone he always promised would someday move to Canada, and someone this country, he says, has a moral obligation to help.
Paul, to review what listeners are likely already familiar with, the somber reality, the chaotic reality in Afghanistan right now, of course, this past Sunday, Canada suspended diplomatic operations in Afghanistan. We closed our embassy in Kabul. And we encourage Canadians to come back. That, of course, was the same day that Justin Trudeau announced an election. And the world has been watching as just all hell has broken loose and just this remarkable footage. I can't really think of anything like it that I've seen in my life of Afghans so desperate to leave that they are literally chasing a U.S.-bound plane down the tarmac and grasping onto it. Some of them later falling to their death, we are told. On and on it goes as we try to grapple with this exit, this, I think, botched and blundered exit. Before we get into the coverage, you have reported from Afghanistan, correct?
That's right. Starting way back in December of 1996, when the first Taliban government was freshly in Kabul.
What do you make and what have you made of the news coverage this past week?
Any expert, anyone with any experience in Afghanistan will tell you that it is a complicated place. Forgive the use of the term, but it's a tribal society. And there are very few outsiders who understand those complexities. So when you see a collapse of the Afghan government as quickly as the one we just witnessed, understanding those relationships is essential because that's where the deals are done. And they're not done suddenly. Shifting coalitions occurred over months, years. And way back in 2001, I witnessed how this happened. I can tell you about it if you want to hear it.
I think it would be a mistake to have you here and not ask you about that.
There's a mountain range north of Kabul, and high up in the mountains, there's a tunnel that takes you to what's called the Salang Pass. It was built by the Soviets largely to make a more efficient route for their military equipment when they invaded way back in 1979. When the Taliban first took control of Kabul in 1996, the remaining forces were led by a legendary commander named Ahmad Shah Massoud. As he retreated north, he blew up the Salang Tunnel. So come 2001, when I was back, you had to go through a dark tunnel that was full of, twisted rebar and huge chunks of concrete. It was literally like climbing small mountains in the darkness. So you make your way through the tunnel, and then you end up at a front line on a narrow track in the mountains. The Taliban are on one side of the front line. The remaining fighters of the North, what was called the Northern Alliance, are on the southern side of it. The final morning when I went up there, I met the commander of the Northern Alliance forces on a horse, who was next to the commander of the Taliban forces, also on a horse. And I was literally jogging along, and the interpreter was shouting my questions. And I said, "Commander, what's happening? You told me that there would be a fight, so I'm here to watch, and now you're riding horses with the Taliban." And he said, "He's my cousin. We grew up together. My older brother was his friend. We have been sending letters back and forth across the front line for months discussing how we could reconcile." And that happened. And then they moved together, Taliban and Northern Alliance, toward Kabul to help liberate the city. So the lesson of that is that alliances in Afghanistan can shift very quickly, and they do. They're constantly moving. And you really need to understand local relationships if you're going to try to understand what's coming next.
That's fascinating, and that's certainly fascinating given the news this week and given, like, Joe Biden framing this in the way that he did, which saying like, well, why should we continue to fight for Afghans if they're not willing to fight for themselves in terms of any resistance to the Taliban just collapsing, as if it's like, well, this is what you get if you don't have the courage to fight for yourself. And especially after 20 years of basically constricting a good guy, bad guy narrative, the reality that these alliances are a lot more liquid and that Afghans knew that the U.S. would be pulling out and their allies. That was telegraphed. Trump was in a big hurry to get out. This was known for a long time. So when we look at this as if somehow this is what they deserve for failing to resist the Taliban, I think that that's a really necessary bit of context and complexity that stands in contrast to the official U.S. government narrative. I want to focus a bit, if we can, on the Canadian media narrative, because I'm fascinated with how quickly things gel into a focus, a framework of like what we care about. And it seemed to me in listening to the CBC and reading, I mean, this was on Global News, it was again and again about the primary interest was we are abandoning the interpreters and the local fixers. Journalists had translators. Military personnel had local translators who were more than translators. And we hear on the current from a Canadian military veteran saying, well, there's this guy who saved my life and we're abandoning him. And on global news, we have a report, interpreters are fleeing Afghanistan. What's happening and how's Canada helping? Afghan interpreters call for faster resettlement program. I get the argument that, wow, we asked these people to put themselves in harm's way to help us, and now we're cutting and running. And I also get from a practical point of view, when newsrooms are looking to cover this, well, we know someone, and they speak English. Let's call up the interpreter. But somehow, Paul, this seems to me to become like, that's what we're, what about the entire population of this country that we participated in an invasion, which is another way of saying that we invaded. If the interpreters are now vulnerable to the Taliban, what about their families? What about their cousins? What about the entire, like, is this not an occasion for us to go back and have a wider focus and ask what we were doing there to begin with and whether or not we're going to join America on their next international adventure? I know that you've had direct relationships with interpreters there. I'm wondering what you think about what I just said.
It's complicated. There are some people whose lives are at direct risk. I'm working to try to get somebody out of Kandahar right now. I know that the Taliban knows him because when we were working together as part of our work, we had to ask the Taliban questions. And in the course of doing so, the Taliban would sometimes call my Afghan colleague to complain about what I was writing. So one of the most important lessons of war is don't believe your own propaganda. And the Canadian government, our American friends, others have constantly been portraying the Taliban as terrorists. They are a disciplined military force, and any Canadian soldier who's honest, who engaged them in Kandahar, will tell you the same. So when we enter the catastrophe that we're in now, without a plan to deal with it, it's worse than shocking to me. It's a disgrace. And you're right, there are serious implications for moving hundreds of thousands of educated Afghans out of the country, because that happened when the Soviets invaded, and then the Americans backed the Mujahideen, as we know, and the Soviet Union collapsed, and then everyone just left Afghanistan to rot, because most of the people who had the capability to govern the place had left. And you know, Afghanistan has a lot of great infrastructure now, and they have institutions that the Taliban can use if they choose. But I suspect that as this chaos spreads, that there will be foreign forces, because there always are, who will choose to meddle. And then the cycle just continues all over again. And it's too much of this. It's 40 years of this. Do we want another half century?
It's just the whole narrative is so strange to me. I hear, like, you know, phrases like our Afghans. We're specifically talking about our Afghans on Frontburn in this possessive sense, or CTV National News talking about deserving Afghan families. And I hear you talking about let's move educated Afghan families out and the complexities of that. It's the whole country that we are now, we have meddled and we bear some level of moral burden. And yet we still are trapped by our own propaganda. I saw something play out this week that was really concerning. Foreign Affairs Minister Mark Garneau initially on Monday was asked, you know, are you going to recognize the Taliban? Like, if this is who you're leaving there to lead these people, is Canada's government going to work with them? And I think that he actually said the judicious and diplomatic thing, which is it's too early to say. But immediately the Conservatives were in election season and the Conservatives pounced on that. And here's Trudeau's minister saying he's open to recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. They're a terrorist group that doesn't let girls go to school, says the Conservative Party. And immediately Trudeau not wanting to give that political cudgel to O'Toole. And that's a very vulnerable place for Trudeau. Oh, you're soft on the Taliban. You want to talk to the terrorists. That's consistent with how they want to portray Trudeau. So he immediately, I think for completely cynical political reasons, it seems, says, okay, no, actually, Garneau was off base. We have no plans to recognize the Taliban. So we've gotten the politicization of that, which I think might potentially do a huge disservice to the people of Afghanistan.
all for optics.
I agree with you completely. We need to be careful because I presume you, most Canadians, care very much about the basic rights of Afghan people to have security and prosperity and just raise their children for a better future the way we want to. If that is your goal, you need to be careful what you do each day from now on. I know that politicians say one thing while their diplomats are doing quite the opposite, because again, I experienced this in 1996. When I was trying to get into Afghanistan for the first time, I just went to the visa window at the Taliban embassy in Pakistan, in Islamabad, and, you know, filled out my application. And it was clear after 2 or 3 days that I was getting the runaround. They had no plan to give me a visa. So some kind person sort of whispered to me and said, go to your embassy and ask them to support your application. So I did that, and I got an appointment with the political officer at the embassy. He said, as it turns out, I'm meeting with the Taliban ambassador tomorrow. Why don't you come and I'll introduce you? And at the time, Canada did not have diplomatic relations with the Taliban regime, but we were still friendly with them and we were still talking to them. And, you know, I could give you a much worse example. When the Taliban fell in 2001, I wanted to do a quick story in Kabul in the very early days of the remnants of the Taliban government. So I went into different ministry offices looking for what was left. And for some reason, we ended up at the Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources, which, you know, given the state of Afghanistan at the time, it was a ruin. The whole country was in ruins because they'd had years of civil war. So I was sort of shocked to find out that they even had a Ministry of Oil and Natural Resources. And there was the deputy minister sitting at his desk in an empty office with a ragged copy of Time magazine. I think it was several years old, on his desk. And that was it. No phone, no typewriter, nothing. And so we started to chat. And to my shock, he described how senior Taliban officials had been hosted by the Clinton administration in Houston. And all of this was organized by a man named Zalmay Khalilzad. And people will recognize his name popping up from time to time over the past a couple of decades. Most recently, he was head of U.S. negotiations with the Taliban in Doha. But if you go back more than a couple of decades, he was a consultant to a U.S. oil company called Unocal. And the reason that the Clinton administration had hosted senior Taliban officials in Houston was to discuss building a pipeline from Central Asia, the former Soviet republics, which were oil rich. They needed to build a pipeline across Afghanistan and terminate it at Karachi so that it could be loaded onto tankers. The Clinton administration, while decrying abuses of women and the various human rights abuses, was secretly talking to the Taliban about building a pipeline. And the worst part of the story for me was I eventually confirmed with the Northern Alliance, what was left of it, that the Clinton administration had sent a senior State Department official, a woman, who personally met with Ahmad Shah Massoud in his mountain redoubt and urged him to surrender to the Taliban. They wanted complete peace with that surrender so they could build an oil pipeline. And yet one of the strongest voices demanding rights for women and children is Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton's alongside with her. The hypocrisy reeks. It enrages me. I shake when I think about how much hypocrisy there is in Western relations with Afghanistan.
Paul, I got to say, I feel like that hypocrisy is not just at an official level. You know, you were saying some very generous-minded things before about how all well-meaning people want the best for the Afghan people. I think that's maybe generally true in the sense that I hope that everybody's nice and happy and safe. But The truth of the matter is that I'm a little bit leery of the rending of garments and the big emotional displays this week about, our Afghan buddies, we're leaving them high and dry. It's been 20 years of suffering since we meddled. I don't think that anybody cared in any kind of active way, like to care for something the way that you might care for a child or a plant a week ago or a month ago or a year ago or 10 years ago. We kind of forgot that we had anything to do with this. And I feel like the media machinery has built such a monster out of the Taliban that if we discuss it at all, it'll be only to just sort of browbeat ourselves for leaving people at the mercy of this human rights abusing government. You know, I notice that the Taliban are, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about even back then they cared about what was written about them. They're a bit more engaged in PR than I expected them to be. And, you know, there was a Taliban representative being interviewed by a female journalist on Afghanistan television. And they seem to be trying to offer the world assurances that, like, we want to be recognized, we want to govern, and we are not necessarily who you think we are. I kind of wonder if we learn nothing from this, maybe it's that the narrative device that we've placed over this entire region and this entire escapade has failed us utterly, and we might need to rethink this if we are going to actually accept that we have some level of responsibility.
You're touching on what I think is a central point of war reporting. It's easy enough to get a camera crew together or, you know, a reporter and a photographer and sign up with the Canadian military and hang out on Kandahar Air Base and do that kind of stuff. But all you're doing is working as a tool of propaganda. And I know that sounds severe, so let me explain it.
You feel that way about your work as a foreign correspondent?
Some of it, you know, to prepare for speaking with you today, because, you know, this spans more than two decades. I read some of my earlier stuff to refresh my memory, and it's stomach churning. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that in warfare, information is a weapon. And the Taliban are not terrorists in caves. You just get a completely different impression of who they are when you spend some time with them. And don't anyone interpret that as meaning that I like the Taliban. As a journalist, I have to talk to all sorts of people I don't like. But I try to understand who they are and where they're coming from, because I'm interested in the reality, not in the propaganda. If you're a journalist covering a war, if you don't understand that everyone is trying to use you as one of their weapons of propaganda, then you shouldn't be there. And that's important because you need to know that everyone is lying to you. The politicians are lying to you. The military is lying to you. And people will think, well, that's a bit severe. I urge you to read the most recent reporting by a guy named Craig Whitlock at the Washington Post, who went into all the documents, thousands of pages of them, that show precisely how they were lying. All these stories of progress and et cetera, they knew that this was a house of cards. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the most important lie, which, you know, interviews today, it just doesn't come up. The central reason that our adventure in Afghanistan was pointless is that we never persuaded the Pakistanis to stop giving refuge to Taliban fighters. There will be time, it's probably too early because the emergency is unfurling in front of us. But at some point, journalists ought to ask people, why did you think you could win when the Taliban were supported by your closest ally in the region, Pakistan? And, you know, we're talking about journalism, so I can tell you, when I was working for the LA Times on these stories, I actually had an editor tell me, when I was trying to get them to publish a story from Pakistan, where I was, you know, trying to give a detailed picture of how the Pakistanis were betraying Western allies by directly supporting the Taliban. And a desk editor said to me, you know, you have to understand the public mood here. And that was her way of saying that, you know, Americans don't want to hear we're losing. Americans don't want to hear we're being stabbed in the back by our closest ally in the region. And so I said to her, do you want to think about the public mood, or do you want to tell them the truth? And we are still dealing with that problem.
To end our conversation talking about the media, and I'm not talking about the LA Times, Davide Mastracci, writing for Passage here in Canada, had a look at the editorial positions of Canadian newspapers at the time that we were contemplating joining this escapade in Afghanistan. Globe and Mail supported it. Toronto Star supported it. Montreal Gazette supported it. Ottawa Citizen supported it. Vancouver Sun supported it. The National Post supported it.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
Paul Watson, we duly note things in the news that people may not otherwise be paying enough attention to. You know, we paid attention before to what was happening with the old growth logging and the protests against it at Ferry Creek, British Columbia. And, you know, they were corralling media. The RCMP were arresting people and keeping those arrests from the eyes of the media. Media took the RCMP to court. They won. Wonderful day for press freedom in Canada. Cops don't care. Most of the media has left, but there are still some reporters there. And yeah, they're getting arrested. The RCMP have arrested a photographer for Victoria Buzz, Colin Smith. They arrested a bunch of the protesters, including a minor, 13 people. They're still keeping the media away from mass arrests. We're hearing lots of troubling things about how the Mounties are behaving. And I think that the rules, Paul, of this, constant dance between the cops and reporters, where the cops are constantly trying to kind of push and constrain us, and then we fight back, and then sometimes they recognize that we have a right to be there, and then sometimes we have to take them to court, and then a court victory is considered like, okay, now we can do our jobs, we got a court victory. Cops don't give a shit. The rules have changed because the reporters no longer have big institutional support. They're not from CBC, Globe and Mail. They're from little outlets, and they're getting pushed around like never before.
Duly noted, it's a disgrace that the big media companies are not supporting the independent journalists in this. They've got the political weight. They've got the money. Why are they not standing up for press freedom? Why are they leaving it to the little guys? Sad.
What do you have to duly note, Paul?
Staying in British Columbia, yesterday marked the first anniversary of a protest, which includes a man named Tim Takaro. Tim Takaro first climbed into the trees in the Brunette River Conservation Area in the city of Burnaby, which is a suburb of Vancouver, not far from me. And they did this a year ago, he and his supporters, to try to stop the expansion of the Trans Mountain Tar Sands pipeline from Alberta. I duly note this now because I think people have forgotten that the pipeline existed, but a U.S.-based company wanted to expand it. And when they got tired of the delays, they told the Trudeau government, we're going to walk. And as I remember it, this happened very quickly over a weekend. Our former disgraced finance minister quickly announced that Canada, meaning you and me and all the other taxpayers, will bail out this U.S. oil company, buy their pipeline, and complete the expansion. Mm-hmm. I urge any investigative journalist listening, please investigate that deal. We paid too much, we acted too quickly, and now we're stuck with expanding a tar sands pipeline as the world is on fire. There's got to be a crime in there somewhere, and I urge someone to find it.
Duly noted. One last one here. If you're not reading about these things that we duly note, or anything with a political dimension on Facebook, on your newsfeed in Facebook, or if you're just reading a lot less newsy political stuff on Facebook, that is by design. CBC reports that Canadians will see less politics on Facebook during the election. Kevin Chan, who is the guy who kind of runs Facebook stuff in Canada, says one of the things that we're doing, which we've been doing since February, is looking at the ways that we can reduce the distribution of political content. We're not removing political content. This is just a question of whether, you know, people say they want to see five or six things in a session. We got to rank them in some way. So what's actually going on here? I think people should be very aware, and this is part of the larger conversation of what's happening with news and fake news and all of this kind of like Facebook and news relationship stuff, is when misinformation and fake news became maybe the biggest liability in Facebook's massive business interest, the ways in which they dealt with it include, okay, we'll just give you a lot less news. Let's give the people what they want. And I have no doubt that if you go to the people and you say, do you want to see more political shit on Facebook or less? They'll say, oh yeah, less. And then, you know, they're smart. And I, you know, it's probably what I would do if I were making these decisions. You don't remove the news. That's censorship. You just change the algorithm so it doesn't show up so much. And, you know, to deal with these messy questions of like, well, we're getting all this shit for misinformation and fake news. Well, we got two options here. We can either like take on the responsibility of being the ones who determine whether news is good or bad, which seems like a lot of trouble and we can't get a robot to do it, which is how we like to do things. Or we can just sort of like get a list of the good news and maybe the government can make that list for us. And so that is the process that is underway. And I think throttling of political stuff is part of it. Listeners will know that I have my own disclosure here. As Facebook is deciding on a category of legit news and then everything else, Canada Land is very much trying to get into that category of legit news, because part of our job is to make sure that our stuff gets seen and read by people and has impact. And Facebook, for their own purposes, want to pay news outlets that make the cut. And we like that too. But, you know, that doesn't constrain me from offering my analysis of what is actually going on here. When you have the newspaper lobby in concert with the government smacking them on a daily basis in the pages of every major newspaper for fake news and with policy threats, this is how Facebook will respond. And this is the new regime of information in Canada.
It disturbs me to hear that you have to deal with an algorithm which is making it difficult for people to hear these conversations. Duly noted.
I want the works. I want the whole works. Presents and prizes and sweets and surprises of all shapes and sizes. And now, don't care how. I want
a majority.
All right. It's sort of lost in audio, Paul... the face of Veruca Salt was replaced with Justin Trudeau's face. Very poorly, very poorly slapped on, the implication being that Justin Trudeau is a spoiled little girl who just wants his majority. And that was the ad that went viral and got everybody talking, I guess talking for the first time in this election cycle and before, about Erin O'Toole and the Conservatives. Not in a nice way, but they were talking about the Conservatives. What did you think about that ad that was so widely ridiculed?
I despair, because where are the grown-ups? Where are the smart people running this country? They seem to have all disappeared.
You know, we get the politics we deserve.
That's it.
This is my analysis of it, okay? That ad, everybody was talking about it to make fun of it. And then there was a similar thing when the conservatives put out their platform. They formatted it like a men's health cover, and Erin O'Toole, who's really been getting in shape, is posing and looks a lot like Mr. Clean and is airbrushed to hell. And it has this weird come hither creepy look on his glossy face. And people were like, what the, that's a strange flex from the conservatives. And those two things, everyone was making fun of him. But Erin O'Toole has failed to get anyone to even notice him previous to this. And you know, we can talk about the failures there. All the different days in which Trudeau was enraging Canadians through the pandemic, where Erin O'Toole failed to seize the spotlight and you know, effectively present opposition, criticize in a way that felt like it had any gravitas to it. And I don't think that prior to these ads, 1 in 1,000 Canadians could name Erin O'Toole as the leader of the Conservatives. I don't know, Paul. Like, the argument goes, like, am I saying that any attention is good attention? Like, I suppose if Erin O'Toole shat himself while delivering a speech, everyone would know his name all of a sudden as well. That doesn't mean he's going to be prime minister. However, what would make you not despair, perhaps, let me suggest, would be if they ran a principled, factual campaign where perhaps they merely documented the Liberal government's hypocrisy, making the exact same point that Trudeau is merely cynically looking for a majority government and putting Canadians at risk and is a hypocrite. They might make an ad in which they montage Justin Trudeau and other Liberal MPs talking about how a pandemic is no time for an election. And at an earlier point when it was politically convenient and expedient for them to say so, they said, we don't want to have an election. Canadians don't want to have an election. It's a pandemic, no election. And then contrast that with the simple fact that, well, now he wants an election because he thinks he can get a majority. Paul, they also made that ad, and nobody watched it.
Mm. We are so far down this road, I will sound naive saying this, but I'll say it anyway. I hope for the day when parents tell their children, if you dare date a political consultant, you will not be welcome at our dinner table. decades ago, the media writers gave them the term spin doctors. So it normalized this nonsense. They are professional liars. And you know better than I, the amount of money that is made by people who have very cynical minds and create the sort of things we're talking about. And I suspect you're right, that they don't look at it the way we look at it. That they just look at clicks and all those things that don't matter. I'm not advocating boring politics. I'm just advocating real government where people do what they say and respect voters as adults.
Paul, there but for the grace of God, I could see myself in their position. I almost have to constrain myself from if it was my job to get Canadians to know who Erin O'Toole was, I might make these ads if I was good at my job, you know? I guess I just feel like, again, we can put a pox on the house of every spin doctor and the political machinery and the politicians themselves, but Canadians only engage with their own democracy under great duress and irritation. So the fact that our politicians do a dumb dance and perform in slapstick or like Trudeau, talk to us like we are little children in order to get through to us, it might say more about us than them.
I agree. But the media also normalizes this stuff. It's just accepted now that paid political operatives appear as so-called analysts on panels on all the TV networks. The journalists are playing this little game that they think is all terribly clever, but they're only helping professional liars lie to voters. And if the media thinks that's good for democracy, I'd like to have a conversation. They need to expose it. If someone makes a crazy ad, tell me who's the company? Who's responsible for this garbage? And then people can send emails and phone them and say, stop it.
It's an excellent point. Listeners might search the Canada Land archives for the name Jeff Ballingall. Paul, thank you. It is tremendously interesting and fascinating and incredibly depressing to speak with you this week. I hope you'll do it again soon.
I love chatting with you, Jesse. Thanks a lot.
That was Shortcuts. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read everything that you send in. Paul Watson, where can people find you? Where can they find your writing?
I have a website. It's called arcticstarcreativity.com, which is hard to remember. So just Google Paul Watson, an official website, and you'll see some stuff there.
I think a lot of people, after hearing this, are going to want to read what you have to say about war. Can you tell us about the book that you authored?
Yeah, it's called Where War Lives. You can still buy it on Kindle. And details of some of the things we've been talking about, anecdotes, are in there. So you get a much better understanding of what I was trying to say.
Where War Lives. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb, with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Listener, if you like what we do, help us do it. Get ad-free episodes and other stuff by going to canadaland.com/join, or just click on the link in the show notes. It takes but a minute.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.